Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN Human Rights Council debated a call on Friday for the immediate release of Myanmar's democratically elected leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, along with other senior officials, in a special session at the Geneva-based Council, which is the preeminent forum for international rights issues. The United Kingdom and European Union presented a draft resolution condemning last week's military takeover. The draft text urges the lifting of restrictions on the internet and unimpeded humanitarian access. Here's Nada Al-Nashif, Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights.
Let us be clear. The indiscriminate use of lethal or less than lethal weapons against peaceful protesters is unacceptable. More violence against Myanmar's people will only compound the illegitimacy of the coup and the culpability of its leaders.
Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in Myanmar, Thomas Andrews, also urged the international community not to recognize the country's military leaders. Arbitrary detentions and intimidation are increasing, the independent rights expert continued, adding that political leaders were targets, as well as community and civil society leaders. Myanmar's ambassador, Myint Thu, responded by underscoring his country's commitment to democratic values and justified the military's intervention as necessary. A constellation of sometimes debilitating symptoms among people who've recovered from COVID-19 is set to impact on global health systems. That's the message from the World Health Organization, WHO, on Friday, which said that post-COVID-19 condition can occur after the acute illness has passed. Symptoms include neurological and physical problems, and these have prevented sufferers from returning to work, occurring up to 6 months after the initial recovery period, said Dr. Janet Diaz, head of healthcare readiness at the UN agency. Although comprehensive data is not yet available, Dr. Diaz insisted that these symptoms were real.
We are concerned, obviously, with the numbers of patients infected with SARS-CoV-2 virus, that the numbers, even if it's, we don't know how common it is or how uncommon it is, but the numbers, just by the magnitude of the pandemic, will impact health systems.
Dr. Diaz added that the condition has also been reported among people who had not been hospitalized for acute infection after the acute illness had passed. Acute malnutrition now threatens half of children under 5 in Yemen in 2021, and 400,000 could die if they do not receive treatment urgently, UN humanitarians have warned. According to four UN agencies, nearly 2.3 million youngsters are likely to suffer acute malnutrition this year throughout the country, which has been at war for 6 years. In their latest report on the crisis, the humanitarians warned that malnutrition damages a child's physical and mental development, especially during the first 2 years of life. It is largely irreversible, perpetuating illness, poverty and inequality, added the Food and Agriculture Organization, the UN Children's Fund, the World Food Programme and the World Health Organization. Preventing malnutrition and addressing its devastating impact starts with good maternal health, yet around 1.2 million pregnant or breastfeeding women in Yemen are projected to be acutely malnourished in 2021, according to latest UN data. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We're all about fixing our economy so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler, joined later by John Christensen. Coming up later, we've got some really helpful lessons to equip us all for pushing together towards the next landslide of change.
If we on our side have every fact and every policy, and the other side have all of the stories, the passion, the emotion, the excitement, then we'll lose.
I'll be speaking to activist and writer Ben Phillips about how to fight inequality. Believe it or not, the TaxCast is entering its 10th year this year, so to celebrate we've got a new logo. I hope you like it. It's not necessarily showing up yet in all of the apps that we have. But anyway, it was about time we got a snazzy new look. Let me know what you think by emailing me on naomi@taxjustice.net. You can subscribe by emailing me there too, or just find us on your favourite podcast app or radio station. Okay, so no time for news headlines this month. We're going to go straight to John Christensen now of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, well, happy new year. It's a year we think that's going to cement the global power of China and It looks like the continuing demise of the UK and the United States unless they get to grips with their shareholder capitalism models. Let's talk a bit about why that demise seems set to continue and how they may really struggle to recover from the COVID crisis, unlike China. And although the Biden administration may not tackle shareholder capitalism as it must do, Biden has still, in his inauguration speech, made some really pretty strong commitments. He said, and I'm quoting, he's going to tackle a raging virus, growing inequality, systemic racism, a climate in crisis. We'll be judged, he said, by how we resolve these cascading crises.
Yeah, good words. And Happy New Year, by the way. I see three historic shifts happening simultaneously during the course of this decade. And at first, as you say, China is steadily moving towards being the world's largest economy. We've already heard, for example, that China sustained growth through 2020 despite the COVID pandemic. And the Chinese are continuing to build their influence, steadily advancing with their Belt and Road Initiative, which is creating this huge trading infrastructure linking 70 or more countries across Asia, Middle East, Africa and Europe. And as their economic reach expands, their political influence inevitably follows. And this is going to present huge challenges to Joe Biden as he takes over at the White House, because his predecessor caused so much harm to US relations with the rest of the world. And the second thing that's happening is the economic development strategies pursued by the United States since the era of Ronald Reagan, and in the United Kingdom, but since Margaret Thatcher, these have largely failed, but neither country shows any signs of making the necessary changes. At the heart of Reaganism was this idea, which you talked about, of shareholder capitalism, which roughly boils down to the notion that the only duty of company directors is to increase the wealth of shareholders. I can do that either by paying bigger dividends or by increasing share values. And that's one of the reasons why, of course, the right-wing media makes such a fetish of stock market movements as a metric of economic success. Now, under shareholder capitalism, the interests of other players, workers, for example, or creditors or local communities, and importantly, the environment, these issues become totally irrelevant to the decisions being taken by the company board of directors because they're only focused on the interests of shareholders. Now, as your quote from Joe Biden's inauguration speech shows, this focus on shareholder capitalism has had severe long-term political and social repercussions, to the extent that it's no longer possible to feel secure about the very survival of democracy. Inequality has reached levels that have been unseen since the 19th century. Investment, particularly in the United Kingdom, but also in the US, has stayed at worryingly low levels, with far too large a proportion of so-called investment going into mergers and acquisitions. And these lead to more concentrated corporate power, often resulting in job cuts, hollowed out businesses burdened with too much debt because the directors have been paying far too much out from profits to shareholders, bigger dividends, whilst also paying themselves vast salaries and bonuses. Now, the third big shift, particularly since the 2008 banking crisis, is the radical right has been pursuing a strategy of trying to reboot capitalism by breaking the international trading order that was steadily built up since the 1950s. Brexit was a much more extreme example. As the European Union started to take steps in 2011-2012 to strengthen financial regulation and restrict tax avoidance, the radical right in the United Kingdom recognised the threat to their development model, which is basically lax regulation and tax dodging. Now, politically, of course, they knew that there was very little public support in Britain for the City of London bankers and for the tax avoiders. So instead, they whipped up a storm around immigration and used that storm to bounce the British public into Brexit. So if we stand back and look at where Trumpism has taken the United States, and where Brexit has taken the United Kingdom, it seems to me that the radical right-wing project has failed, at least for now. Far from imploding under the pressure from Brexit, the European Union's single market remains intact, and Britain now finds itself without a seat at the rulemaking table, and facing a massive additional level of expensive bureaucracy to ship goods across borders into the single market. And meanwhile, if we look at what Trumpism has done in the United States, it might well have brought the United States to a state of low-level permanent civil war. And the Brexit project might well have led to the end of the United Kingdom, with Northern Ireland increasingly aligning economically, politically, and culturally with Ireland, and Scotland electing for independence from Whitehall. So the impacts have been drastic. Going back to China, as the Chinese like to say, may you live in exciting times. The radical right project isn't working, but they haven't so far worked out a way to move forward beyond it.
Yeah, let's contrast what China is doing, because China doesn't have a shareholder capitalism model, and the state is very central. And don't get me wrong, nobody's trying to say that we want anything like the kind of oppressive regime that China is, but they are developing in very, very different ways, aren't they?
Yeah, a lot of people think that China has gone down a capitalist model, and in many respects, yes, capitalism is permissible in China, but you still have a very strong state-led development strategy, which involves a lot of investment in infrastructure, a lot of investment in education, a lot of investment also in social welfare and health, for example, but also alongside that, a great deal of state-led investment in research and development, which means that China has massively increased the productivity of its workforce. I certainly don't want to present it as some kind of paradise, because it isn't. We know of the human rights abuses in China. Nonetheless, they have been much more long-term and strategic in their thinking, and the state has taken a much bigger role in shaping the economy and the social outcomes. Whilst in Britain, United States and other countries that have taken this extreme shareholder capitalism model, the thinking tends to be leave it all to the market to decide, and that tends to be much more short-term in its thinking.
Okay, and so Brexit has happened now. The Singapore strategy seems to be well underway. Now that the UK is kind of separated from the herd, it's sort of humiliation and downfall seems to be accelerating.
Right, well, I mean, the wheels are very quickly coming off the Brexit bus, but the Johnson government just don't seem to know how to reverse out of the mess that's been created. Now, for several years, you and I have been discussing this, the threat of a Singapore and Thames development strategy, which in many respects is just a rerun of what Thatcher tried in the 1980s. For example, there's a lot of talk now about creating 10 or more free ports up and down Britain. Well, Thatcher tried that in the 1980s, and even her supporters came to recognise that it wasn't exactly successful. The problem with free ports now is that they're pretty much irrelevant to the trade-free tariff model that's been negotiated by the EU with the Johnson government. But worse, free ports generally don't attract the type of large-scale investment and investment in high-value-added productive activity that Britain needs at the moment. Now, famously, in the 1980s, the Thatcher free ports became associated with low-value assembly activity. We used to call it screwdriver activity, which involves cheap labour. And the benefits there almost entirely go to the company owners, either through tax breaks or deregulation or whatever. But what's really interesting this time round is that the business community just isn't supporting them in this. Big players in the City of London aren't pushing for deregulation because they still want to have access to the European Union markets for financial services. And they know that if Britain diverges significantly away from European Union regulations, that access will be denied, which is, by the way, is what's happened to Switzerland. And that explains why the Johnson team failed to negotiate access for services as part of the deal, which came into force on the 1st of January this year. Now, equally, businesses aren't calling for tax breaks, and the Treasury, for what it's worth, in London, they're not calling for any more corporate tax breaks either, since there's a general recognition now that cutting the corporate income tax rate or throwing more tax breaks at businesses quite simply doesn't attract new and productive investments. So from where I'm sitting, this is the end of the line for Thatcherism and for shareholder capitalism. It's made a tiny number of people, bankers and private equity people and mergers and acquisition specialists. These people have become spectacularly rich in the past 40 years. But overall, the development strategy has failed the vast majority of people in the United States and in Britain and in other countries that went down this route.
Thanks, John. John will be back with us next month. So, new year, more challenges. But when it comes to being part of the movement for economic transformation and fairness, there are some ingredients that are absolutely essential for us to succeed. On the TaxCast this month, I'm talking to activist and writer Ben Phillips. He's lived and worked in 4 continents and 14 cities, and he's written a book I found really useful, How to Fight Inequality and Why That Fight Needs You. Ben, you've lived and worked all over the world, but I thought it's particularly interesting that you were living in South Africa in a township just after the freedom struggle succeeded in bringing down the apartheid regime. It doesn't get a lot harder than that, does it, as a climate of struggle? Apartheid seemed unassailable for such a long time. Would you say that's one of the places that's taught you the most, maybe, about fighting inequality and successful fights against inequality?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the one that kind of seared in my brain. Mamelodi is the main township of Pretoria, which was the capital city. So it was a very active centre of struggle. And I was the only white person living there because prior to 1990, there'd been a formal legal separation of people. Mandela became president in June, following an election that took place in April of that year. I arrived in September. So it wasn't a struggle that I had helped to win. It was a struggle that I was learning about from those who had won it. And the key lesson that I learned from them, that they taught me, was about how when the famous leaders of the ANC were either in prison or in exile, the struggle was carried on and won by ordinary people, by workers in trade unions, by community organizations, women's groups, priests, even school kids had helped to lead and push. So it wasn't a story of just one or two famous faces, heroic though they were, but was much more importantly and much more inspiringly a story of how collectively ordinary people were able to achieve great change. And one day I was taken by my friends to hear Nelson Mandela speak in a football stadium, and there were 30,000 people around the stadium. And as Mandela spoke, I looked at him and I realized 2 things. And the first was that Mandela was a hero. But the second was that I wasn't in a stadium observing one hero. I was observing 30,000 heroes. That the victory against apartheid had not been the victory of one man, great though he was, but had been the victory of thousands and millions organizing and pushing together. Later on, I read something by Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He said, Mandela's just a pebble on the beach, a beautiful pebble, but nevertheless, just a pebble. And what he meant was that the story of the victory against apartheid was this collective story. And as I look back at other historical examples of when grotesque inequality had been beaten, I found a pattern, which was that it was never self-correcting. It was never given by elites. But also, the popular struggle that won it really was a popular struggle. And the famous, inspiring leaders who we recall were really embodiments made possible by the struggle of so many others. So if we are today to tackle grotesque inequalities, it won't be given to us. But neither should we look for stars who will redeem us. Collectively, we will redeem ourselves.
Yes. I thought that was really fascinating how Desmond Tutu described Mandela, you know, as a hero among many heroes. And what's also really interesting about your book, I think, is that really important reminder of how long-term protest and pressure is and needs to be. You know, it needs to be ongoing. And you point out that some of the achievements, the big reductions in poverty in Brazil, for example, and in South Africa for a time, those big reductions lessened when the popular pressure kind of diminished. You talk about how, for example, in South Africa, there was a kind of deference to the ANC government. And, you know, in Brazil also, the strong challenge from below kind of abated because after decades of struggle, I guess popular movements thought, oh, OK, now the right people are finally in power. And you point out in your book that we forget that, you know, Lula's party in Brazil, for example, got to power only after decades of pressure and fighting and struggle. That's such an important point you're making there.
There is a challenge for organisers around timescales, which is that in moments of crisis, time can appear to move very, very fast, and does, and one needs to act very, very quickly. But almost always, what enables a crisis to be an opportunity for one side or the other is years of preparation. And so what can appear to happen very quickly is more like a kind of landslide that has been building up over a period. And the job of organizers is not just to respond quickly in those moments of crises, but is also to build up in advance of them and to accept that in those long struggles in advance of the moment of opportunity, there will be periods where it looks bleak and where it's hard to see a way ahead. But unless the preparatory work is done in those periods, then those moments of opportunity become moments of opportunity for someone else. I think that collectively, progressive movements failed to establish such a foothold prior to the 2008 crash. And so the 2008 crash, which really demonstrated the utter failure of neoliberalism to deliver for ordinary people, we saw really nobody from the banks and politics who'd been so complicit in the failures pay the price. And it became a push for retrenchment and austerity. And at the same time, the frustration with elites was twisted into a bigoted populism that attacked minorities, attacked the progress that had been made in women's rights, attacked movement across borders. And part of that is, you know, life's unfair, that those forces of reaction will always be better funded. That's a context that we just have to deal with. It's also, you know, an achievement in a sick way by the bigots who were hugely well organized. Ironically, ultranationalists' ability to organize internationally at points exceeds progressives' ability to organize internationally. And it's also, we have to be honest with ourselves, we weren't ready for that moment and we didn't have the organizational strength and we missed that moment. Now, in the COVID crisis, which is really exposing and collapsing the status quo, we don't know what will follow. There is a real danger, again, that the principal beneficiaries become the liars and fascists. But there is an opportunity for a case to be made effectively to people and for effective organizing to be done around a recognition of interdependence. The disease so clearly demonstrates how one person's misfortune or danger is another person's misfortune or danger, but also the economic impact that has been wreaked on people in the context of COVID has also demonstrated that a kind of ungiving state with no redistributive function doesn't work, not just for those at the bottom, but doesn't work for really anybody, right up until maybe the top one or even a smaller percent of that. So there is an opportunity, but if we don't seize it, if we don't use it, then other people will.
Yeah. What happened in the lead up to 2008 and afterwards, you know, it didn't go the way that it should have done. But now, yes, there's a wider understanding about our interdependence and the role of the state as well, that only the state can take certain actions to protect people. And that understanding is so important in terms of addressing the climate crisis as well. And that sort of brings me to ask you about another point that you make in the book, which is about connecting up different struggles, because they are all connected.
They are. You can build a supermajority if you connect different struggles. The Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign in the US calls this fusion coalitions. And when I look back at history, at how victories against inequality had been won in the past, there had always been these kind of fusion coalitions. Those who want to save the planet, those who want to tackle racial injustice, those who want to end the runaway wealth of a tiny 1% at the top, those who want to have a fair society in terms of relations between women and men. All of these different progressive forces united have the potential to succeed. Separated, don't. Most people don't engage with politics for one policy or as a kind of issue obsessive. That's much more common amongst intellectuals or, you know, think tank folks, but most people don't see things that way. They look for a composite picture. When we've been successful in the past, for example, the post-1945 changes that happened, whether that's in the UK or Europe or the US, they happened together. So huge numbers of policies happened at the same time. And they happened because there was an overarching story, and that story was fundamentally a moral one, not an issue-based one. Across the world, we saw after World War II this notion that we needed to build a society that worked for everyone, having gone through a crisis that had hit everybody. And I think now after COVID, we need something similar. So we need a narrative, a story about what kind of society we need to build. From that, the policies will flow.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about exactly that, actually, in terms of stories versus facts. Or probably versus isn't a very good way of putting it, because obviously tools and data and policy proposals are really important. But when it comes to campaigning and connecting with each other and communicating and pushing forward together, you point out so well in the book, there's no historical evidence that facts and presentations change things. I think you quote a South African trade unionist as saying, "No one cedes power because of a great PowerPoint." And there's a quote from another union organiser in the US that you give that I really love. And he said, "A pamphlet, no matter how good, is never read more than once. But a song is learned by heart and repeated over and over." And for me, that's really key to everything that people are trying to do when they're working for change in the public interest, or we should be. I mean, especially with doing the TaxCast and trying to get across information that I feel is important, but to fit that into the stories of our lives, you know.
Absolutely. It's interesting with the neoliberals that, you know, the most famous and most impactful neoliberal is not one of their intellectuals, like Milton Friedman, for example, but it's Ronald Reagan, who was first a movie star, then a propagandist, and then a president. And if we on our side have every fact and every policy, and on the other side, all of the stories, the passion, the emotion, the excitement, then we'll lose. And this is where I think progressives need to be serious about how change happens. So many of us want to think of ourselves as evidence-based people. And yet, when we're asked how will we bring about change, we often default to, well, we'll present evidence. But when one looks at the evidence of when change has been brought about on a transformational scale, it is almost never, or at least I couldn't find any case, where it had ever been because experts had presented evidence. Our strategy for change can't be based only on the sharing of evidence. I think that's a difficult hump for many progressives to get over. But if we don't, then all we'll do is be ever more articulate commentators on why we're losing.
Yeah. Lots of talking and not enough connecting too. And I think the question people always ask is, yes, I agree with everything you're saying, but what can I do? And I remember when Extinction Rebellion was blockading the centre of London not so long ago, before COVID, peacefully for weeks. I remember me and Nick Shackson were going around the different barricades talking about economics and tax in the public interest with the people there. And two women put their hands up to get the mic and they said, you know, we agree with everything you're saying, but what can we do? And I was saying to them at the time, well, you are doing it because you're here. I mean, we're all here now. After reading your book, I thought, in terms of building collective power and the idea of the thousands of heroes, I think maybe it wasn't such a bad answer.
I think it was a great answer. I mean, I think one place in which I would challenge some activism is that when we look at when organizing has been impactful, it hasn't been principally through the most dramatic, romantic moments. So a march is one thing, but what matters more is whether after the march people have a sense of being a collective and are ready and keen to do something next, so that they've actually formed themselves not just into a demonstration of anguish, but a demonstration of collective power. It's the long-term processes, and I think these are sometimes forgotten. I went back and looked, for example, at the Montgomery bus boycott, the famous story of Black Americans refusing to sit on the bus until the bus companies and the state government ended the policy which pushed Black people to the back of the bus. And sometimes people remember this story as Rosa Parks was tired and refused to move. And then Martin Luther King gave an inspiring speech, and then it changed. That is absolutely not what happened, but what did happen is actually more exciting, which is that for 2 years previously, a group of African American women planned and organized what was going to happen. So Rosa Parks wasn't tired, she was trained and she was ready. And then for a year afterwards, they had to carry on this difficult and logistical operation to get people to their places of work from their homes without using the buses. And they worked, for example, with the postmen, because the postmen knew where everybody was and were able to map the city. They worked with the taxi companies. They worked with people who had cars but didn't actually take the bus in order to work in solidarity with them. They worked with the Black churches because that's where people met and gathered every week, and that became a key organizing place. And illegally at night, university staff, and some of them lost their jobs for doing that, printed thousands and thousands of leaflets around the boycott. Unless all that had happened, the boycott would not have succeeded. So the kind of grand bits that appear in movies are the least important bits. And there's a danger in activism that we think it is the dramatic moments that lead to change, when often it's actually much more the everyday organizing.
Yeah, and it's so important that we really get the different stages of struggle. And in your book, you kind of tweaked Gandhi's famous saying a bit. So first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then, and this is your part, then they tell you you've won, and then if you keep pushing, then you really win. And I so agreed with what you're saying in the book, that we're in that very dangerous place at the moment, a kind of plateau where power is telling us that on so many things they agree with us. Yeah, inequality is bad. Yes, we need to stop killing the planet. But they're not actually doing what needs to be done.
Yeah, I feel, you know, not at that level to rework Gandhi, but I did. But it does seem that actually there is a moment in between when the elite very cleverly declares you the victor and declares that they agree with you. And that, in a way, is the most dangerous moment in any process of reform. That's where we got to on inequality. Now, it's very hard to find a World Bank report that doesn't say that inequality is bad on page one or two. Every single government has signed up to the Sustainable Development Goals. Goal number 10 pledges to reduce inequality both within and between countries. So they've said, we agree. That contradiction shows us that we have to really beware this moment. I think we're at that moment also on tax. So now, for example, we have the IMF almost saying that they support wealth taxes. You have mainstream economics saying austerity is counterproductive and that systems of private insurance, for example, to provide for health or for risk of unemployment cannot any longer be said to work. So we need tax-based systems. Now we have to hold their feet to the fire around actual delivery. I'm optimistic, but only because I've seen how powerful we ordinary people are when we act together. And this book is a weapon for people to use non-violently in a struggle that they will, I believe, win.
Thanks, Ben. You've been listening to Ben Phillips talking about his book, How to Fight Inequality and Why That Fight Needs You. It's published by Polity Press. Well worth reading. Okay, that's it for this month on the TaxCast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next month.
Can't make the climate math work without decarbonizing where we live and where we do business.
For us, it's really a key consideration to make sure that this urbanization and this new housing stock can contribute to reduce the greenhouse gas emission.
You're listening to The Lid Is On with me, Conor Lennon. Even though the COVID-19 pandemic has put a dent in commuting and other forms of travel, New York is still a busy city, teeming with traffic. But petrol and diesel are far from being the main sources of greenhouse gas emissions here. That dubious honor goes to buildings. More than two-thirds of the city's carbon footprint comes from the energy that goes into heating, cooling, or lighting buildings. New York State has an ambitious plan to significantly reduce its carbon emissions by 85% by mid-century, but here in the city, a dense metropolis full of buildings from different eras, the scale of this task is plain. Janet Joseph from the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority accepts that the challenge is significant, but it needs to be tackled.
Building decarbonization is one of the more significant challenges in our climate agenda. But, you know, you really can't make the climate math work without decarbonizing where we live and where we do business. So that means bringing to scale many different solutions and overcoming barriers in the millions of buildings that we have across New York State. And we have over 4 million buildings in New York State, and 70% of these buildings were constructed before the emergence of the energy code. So these buildings, they were not designed to be energy efficient. And if you look out your window, you could probably glean as much. So many, and I would say the majority of these buildings will need to be retrofitted or upgraded in some way, shape, or form over the next few decades to reduce carbon pollution and to achieve our greenhouse gas reduction goals. So that's what we're very focused on, and we have many different strategies to try to drive progress on that front.
That was Janet Joseph, Senior Vice President for Strategy at the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, explaining why the state needs to get to grips with the energy leaking out of inefficient buildings. And one of the strategies for cutting the state's carbon footprint involves finding ways to ensure that new buildings use just a small fraction of the energy needed by conventional buildings for heating and cooling. On a snowy, windy day in February, I headed to the Bushwick neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, to meet Chris Benedict, an architect based in Manhattan who's had her own practice since 1995 and has always been interested in designing buildings that are as environmentally sound as possible. She wanted to show me two of her projects commissioned by the Riseborough Community Partnership, which develops low-budget housing for low-income families, senior citizens, and other populations with special needs, with an emphasis on energy efficiency. Both projects demonstrate that it is possible to dramatically slash energy needs without costs rising through the roof. The first is a recently built construction for senior citizens, which meets strict ultra-low energy or passive house standards.
This building is special because it was either the first or one of the first new construction buildings, and definitely the first affordable housing building in New York City, where we sought to meet the passive house standard. It was an empty lot. There was grass growing in here, and a lot of the construction was very typical. The exterior of this building is now clad with insulation, which was an unusual thing to do in 2005. And we like putting insulation on the outside of buildings because it keeps all the thermal mass of the building inside of the insulation and keeps the temperature inside very steady. We also like insulation on the outside of the building because it keeps condensation from happening inside of the building because the walls are warm and there's no condensing surface, so it improves the health of the people in the building by insulating on the outside. There's a lot of things going on in buildings right now with regard to their mechanical systems that could be improved, that could bring us a big jump forward.
Why is it so important for it to be airtight?
There's normally in all buildings here in New York a lot of building leakage. So in the winter, buildings experience something called the stack effect, which is a physical effect where air at the bottom of the building that is warmed up rises up through the building and then pulls more cold air in at the bottom. So often in New York, people are very uncomfortable on the first floor if they live there, and they're overheated at the top and they open their window. And this is a cycle we can control by creating an air barrier to reduce the stack effect in the building. They might have steam boiler systems, so steam is on and off. Steam has to heat all of the radiators up in the entire building. Water condenses and comes back down to the boiler again. But people only get heat when the steam gets up there, condenses, and the heat comes out into the room. Then the heat goes away, and so you have to keep doing that. It's hard to maintain temperature in a steam-heated building. And so a lot of energy is used for that. Often the radiators are oversized for the rooms, and then the buildings don't have insulation. So you're losing the heat that you put in at a very quick rate. You know, that's kind of the poetic and beautiful thing about a passive house is you're cutting down the rate of heat loss out of the building enclosure, and you're making up for that heat with the people and the lights and everything else that goes on inside of the building. So you're matching the rate of the occupants and what they do with the rate of the heat going through the enclosure. So it's kind of a poetic, beautiful thing.
But Ms. Benedict is not only concerned with designing new buildings to the highest environmental standards, she's also helping to transform those extremely leaky buildings she mentioned.
We are on Grove Street in Brooklyn, and these are four buildings that are part of a 9-building project called Casa Passiva. And the project is to take existing buildings and bring them to the passive house standard. The passive house is based mostly on creating an airtight enclosure that is insulated with continuous insulation, ventilation that is done with heat recovery so that when we're taking heated air or air-conditioned air out of an apartment, we're taking the energy that we put into that conditioning and putting it back into the incoming airstream.
You've really put a new, brand new skin, an outer layer on this existing building. How complicated is that to do?
Well, you know, it kind of looks simple when you look at it now, but it was a puzzle to figure it out.
Whilst projects such as Casa Passiva are encouraging examples of innovation driving the climate action agenda, it's clear that they can't take place in isolation. As Janet Joseph explains, joined-up thinking is needed if the city and state are to achieve their goals.
We need high-efficiency electricity to heat and cool our buildings. So that means moving off of the fossil fuel-based sources of heating that we have today for buildings. We need to make our buildings energy efficient so that we can contain the costs associated with expanding the electric grid, because we are going to need to build out the electric grid if we are to electrify, you know, the 4 million buildings in New York State. And then the third thing we need to do is incorporate more load flexibility into buildings so that buildings can communicate with the electric grid and buildings can ramp down and ramp up their loads to balance the overall system.
And whilst established cities such as New York are grappling with the legacy of their past, other parts of the world are urbanizing at breakneck speed, potentially storing up problems for the future. Christophe Lalonde is the head of the housing unit at UN Habitat, the UN agency that promotes safe and sustainable urban environments. A supporter of retrofitting projects like Casa Passiva, which improve existing housing stock, he's confident that the developing economies of the global south can benefit from the kind of innovation seen in New York.
From the perspective of our work on housing, we see that a very large share of the emissions to come are part of the new housing stock that is required to be built in the near future. So when we work as UN Habitat, you know, on the future of cities, the future of urbanization, for us it's really a key consideration to make sure that this urbanization and this new housing stock can mitigate the impact on the climate, but also contribute to reduce the greenhouse gas emission. Some companies are 3D printing houses in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa. And some years ago, this would have not been the most attractive approach to reducing greenhouse gas emission, and especially from the cultural point of view. But it's a very interesting solution to be able to produce housing at scale, at low cost, but also by streamlining the way that you are building housing and also sourcing materials. You can really have a positive impact on the environment by reducing these emissions.
Christophe Lalonde, head of housing at UN Habitat. Back in New York, no one is underestimating the scale of the task ahead, but there is a sense that the political, technical, and logistical stars are aligning, and that we have a fighting chance of achieving the goal of bringing down global temperatures one building at a time.
It's not rocket science, the challenges that we need to achieve. There's just a lot of issues we need to work out on the ground. We got to get the costs down.
Are we going to get there? I don't know. I mean, I've traveled to some European countries where they set these goals and they say they're going to try. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to try.
I'm Connor Lennon, and you've been listening to The Lid Is On, the flagship podcast from UN News. For daily text, audio, and video stories, go to our website, news.un.org.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. Well, some cancer patients are at higher risk from COVID-related illness or even death. But the World Health Organization's advice is clear. Do not stay away from going to see your doctor if you need treatment or a professional diagnosis. In an interview with Daniel Johnson, the UN Health Agency's Dr. Andre El-Bawi from WHO's Department of Non-Communicable Diseases explains how the coronavirus has had a profound impact on cancer care in rich and poor countries, and how some are coming up with solutions to this potentially deadly trade-off.
The impact of COVID on cancer care has been profound because it has impacted all dimensions of cancer control, from diagnosis to survivorship care. And in that regard, it has been a high impact and unfortunately very challenging time for the most vulnerable cancer patients that we see.
This is worldwide, is it, in rich and poor countries?
This is correct. We see this impact in both high-income countries and in lower- and middle-income countries.
Is it the case that health authorities have scaled back their cancer care after reports that COVID-19 outcomes are significantly worse among patients with cancer?
There is a variety of responses that governments have taken on. Many of them have had, in fact, a positive benefit. Most governments are avoiding this concept of let's reduce cancer care because we know cancer is a time-sensitive disease. If we, in fact, delay cancer care, either because of a government order or because of a patient choice or because of a situation in quarantine, the consequences can be detrimental. And for this reason, we've seen governments respond favorably to the extent that they are encouraging cancer patients to pursue care, to continue with care, and to complete their therapy.
Right, so let's put ourselves in a patient's shoes, a cancer patient's shoes. They have a cancer, so they should carry on going to the hospital, even though they might have heard somewhere that if they catch COVID, they have a greater chance of being at risk. Is that right?
That is correct. The first starting point, as you rightly point out, is the understanding that some cancer patients are at higher risk for COVID-related disability or death if they contract the virus. But at
Why
the same
is that?
time, Because it has to do with immunosuppression, we believe. The exact mechanism for which the virus is causing this increased risk of death for the cancer population, we are still trying to understand from a disease perspective. But one of the primary drivers is a weakened immune system and a likelihood that the virus will take a greater hold, spread more rapidly within the body, and by extent, cause greater damage. That is the hypothesis. But we are also trying to understand which cancer patients are at greatest risk, because not all cancer patients are experiencing the potential harm of COVID and cancer to the same extent. For example, we have noted that some cancer patients that have what we call blood cancers or hematologic cancers are those that are experiencing greater risk as compared to some other types of cancers that are solid or the organ-based cancers like breast or colorectal that may be at lower risk. But the exact likelihood that each cancer type incurs a greater risk is something that, again, we don't have a clear understanding because the data are still not well available for us to understand who is at greatest risk. The general message, though, is we know as a general group that cancer patients are experiencing greater disability and death from COVID. And because of this, there is a trade-off that many cancer patients are making, sometimes in isolation, but importantly, in a discussion with their healthcare provider to understand what is the right course of action for treatment given this trade-off potential harm from increased exposure from COVID and also potential harm from delaying or interrupting their cancer therapy.
So if you're a cancer specialist, an oncologist, it must be very difficult for you because COVID has meant that you've had to change your approach in the sense that you're still needing to catch these cancers early, but you also have to give the palliative care to those whose cancers cannot be cured.
It is a very challenging time for patients, and we should think about that first and foremost. People who have cancer or who are fearful that they have cancer and are unable to get to a healthcare clinic or hospital to better understand their condition. But also, it has been a very challenging time for cancer providers because they are also in a difficult trade-off where there are needs to respond to the greater epidemic that is a threat to hospitals that are overburdened with increased number of patients, and yet at the same time still need to be able to provide care for the cancer patients that they have. And in that regard, the options that they have, whether it is the timing of surgery, the number of cycles of chemotherapy, or the availability of medicines, including dosing for radiotherapy, all of these decisions are needing to be made by cancer providers and their patients in a very intimate, yet also a very challenging discussion that is happening in clinics around the world.
Could you maybe give some advice from the World Health Organization on which of these COVID vaccines are best for cancer patients to take, or is it just too soon to say?
This is unfortunately too soon to say, but it is an important discussion that cancer patients should take on with their providers, because there are some emerging studies that are helping us understand, is there increased risk for cancer patients to take the vaccine? The suspicion is that cancer patients will be, in fact, benefiting from access to vaccines rather than being harmed. But unfortunately, as you rightly said, this is too early to say conclusively. We have regulatory authorities around the world that are actively following this, and we, of course, at WHO are doing the same.
Thank you. Maybe you could give me an idea about some countries who've managed to work with COVID and find solutions to getting treatment to cancer sufferers more quickly than others.
Yeah, this is an area where we've been working hard with governments, with stakeholders to understand these types of responses or mitigation strategies. Cancer has not been included as a priority mitigation strategy as part of essential health services, but this is changing. And we are starting to see governments take on new and innovative approaches to ensure that cancer patients are able to access and remain on the therapies that they need. As an example, we've seen in the Netherlands, they've taken on an approach in which there has been outreach to the cancer community, to the general public, to say, if you have any high-risk symptoms, please come to a clinic. Please report your symptoms to a provider. And this could be, again, in a clinic or using an innovative approach like telemedicine. This type of encouragement to the general public has, in fact, reduced the delays that we've seen that are also very common around the world. So this is a best practice that seems to have a very positive impact, which is, again, the use of messaging to the general public and to cancer patients to say, services remain available. Please continue to reach out to the healthcare system and to your providers to receive the care that you need. Another best practice that we're seeing is a strong response from civil society. So we identified some best practices related to an area known as patient navigation. which means that either advocacy organizations, hospitals, or broader communities are providing cancer patients with a focal person to say, here's how we can help you continue with your therapy. We can help you get to the clinic rather than take public transportation and increase the potential risk of exposure. We'll have someone come to your house and pick you up and drive you to the hospital. And these types of approaches, in fact, can also reduce potential harm to cancer patients.
Thank you, Dr. Ibao, for sharing that on best practices. Finally, can I just ask you what the latest thinking is from the World Health Organization on what you eat being linked to cancer? Is it still the case that we should be eating 5 fruit and veg a day, steering clear of red meat, trying not to gain too much weight? It is very confusing. So what is the latest advice from the UN Health Agency, please?
You raise the wisdom of yesteryear that, in fact, is still true today. These healthy lifestyle choices are very important to reduce cancer risk over time. But it's also important to set the stage for what are the most common behavioral choices that impact cancer risk. Because we hear often from communities this tired concept of, well, everything causes cancer, so why should I change my behavior? It's therefore important to also think about what are the major risk factors that continue to drive the cancer burden. Number one, tobacco. Tobacco is still responsible for almost 1/4 of cancer deaths, 25% of cancer deaths, tobacco. But we are also now seeing some increased risk factors that include obesity. And this is true particularly in high-income countries, but again, increased trends in obesity in almost every country around the world, and this will drive the cancer burden for the decades ahead. Alcohol, another important risk factor to consider. And the last group, just to remind people the importance of thinking even about vaccination, as we were discussing earlier, that infectious causes of cancer still are responsible for at least 10% or more of cancer cases around the world. And for that reason, we talk about vaccination like human papillomavirus, HPV vaccine, that can in fact drive us towards the elimination of cervical cancer as a public health problem. This is a priority for our Director General, Dr. Tedros, and for other UN agencies that have now committed to the elimination of cervical cancer. Vaccination is an important public health measure for a variety of reasons. And of course, in this situation, as we talk about today, it can help us towards reducing the cancer burden. So these are some of the important risk factors, but there are others. An emerging one that is also true in many places around the world, air pollution. This is something that people don't necessarily associate with cancer, but it is a risk factor we must pay attention to because it will drive cancer risk in the decades ahead.